what I was struck by is the fact that the only thing that we and our adversaries have exactly the same amount of is time, right? And so when I think about that, that decision parameter, the ability to make decisions faster, the ability to get the right information to respond quicker, you know, if I look at time as a weapon, right? How do I actually help, you know, contribute to wielding that weapon well and effectively?
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Through our blood and your bonds, we crushed the Germans before he got here.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Okay, this is Bonnie Evangelista with the Chief Digital and Artificial Intelligence Office. I am super excited, Alexis, that you have joined me today. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. It's great to see you as always.
Of course. We don't know each other greatly. I feel like we just connect on a lot of things that we're doing work-wise. I will say one of the first things that impressed me about you is when we met on a panel earlier this summer. You were the moderator on a panel I was participating in, and by far the best moderator I have ever come across, either as a participant or a viewer. You were so engaging. You were so good. The flow, you just, it came so naturally to you. I just thank you for that.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think the neatest thing about being a moderator, and in some cases of our roles generally, is just this opportunity to exercise curiosity. Right. And to rub your thoughts up against someone else's thoughts and come away with slightly different thoughts. Right. And in some way, shape or form. And so I am very pleased to know I didn't let you down that day. But, you know, this is something we just get constantly. Right. And being servants at DOD and, you know, is being able to learn from each other. So it's just awesome.
Well, we're going to turn the tables today. I'm going to get curious about you. So give us a quick rundown about your background, and then I don't want to take away your thunder and tell us your current role in the department, how it led you to.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's really interesting about the moment I find myself in now is that it feels like a very much kind of circling of the experiential wagon, if you will. You know, oftentimes I think we look at our career, and if it's been an interesting and exciting one, sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? People always think that these careers should be these perfect kind of progressions, but I often find the most interesting and exciting ways I've grown have been through unexpected, you know, opportunities and experiences. And so, you know, I think to kind of loop four of those together, when I was just first coming out in the ice age, you know, back in the 90s, I was the third employee of the Internet Trade Association. And my job was really to go around to places like Fortune 500 companies and say, hey, this thing, the internet, is going to change how you do business. And what was really interesting, yeah, at that time was that, you know, those same people whose businesses, of course, are incredibly driven by data and the internet told me it was a fad, right? And told me like, oh, this is just, you know, the next thing. And so I highlight that because I think one of the things I've been so lucky to kind of understand is what is it to try to bring individuals and organizations along with change, right? And that was whether it was bricks to clicks, you know, kind of back in the 90s, but
bricks to clicks,
right? Awesome. Right. Remember that? Bricks to clicks, Y2K, yeah. Right? Let's really date myself here. But, you know, we have to think about why I think that's so critical is, you know, even in our work in DOD, that question of what's coming next, how can we be ready for what's next, right? And being able to come into a role that was really about being an ally to people to help them understand what was coming next, how it might impact them, their organizations, was a really neat place to cut my teeth. And then in a weird turn of events, found myself in war zones in Afghanistan and Iraq and many other places with the United Nations and got to, deploy and implement about $5 billion of DOD money in for almost every service. And I think what was really interesting there, Bonnie, that's part of where I fell in love with procurement, right? And the fact that our mission actually happens through our acquisitions and procurement. And you know, while a lot of people may not think that's very sexy, understanding how the machine works, right, in order to help it, you know, help it achieve the mission was really critical. But most importantly, being in those places, right, with warfighters, losing friends, you know, going through different
you know, attacks and being impacted personally, I think was really important to have not only an empathy, but a respect for what it is that, you know, people who serve in our national security and national defense take on every day in their families. Then I was able to, you know, work at USAID and help create the Global Innovation Lab and, you know, really kind of the science, technology, and innovation arm of USAID, right? One of the third legs of the stool, if you will. And I think that was really interesting because you really had to confront what innovation culture and government looked like, right? How you actually tactically shifted that. And then again, another weird turn of events, had the opportunity to go and spend about 3 years at Google. And I really did that with a lot of intention that I would come back to public sector. But I went to Google to really think about three things in particular. The first was, quite frankly, to peek behind the curtain and to understand what was real and what was hype in tech, right? Mm-hmm. What needed to cost $200 million and what was free and no one was using it. And when people said things like, what about privacy and what about security? You know, I wanted to have the answer. The second, though, was culture, right? What is it really that, you know, Google did that was something that I could have done as a federal or defense leader? You know, what was the way that they ticked? And what I found is really about probably 90 to 95% of what I thought was, you know, really interesting and advantaged their culture, I could have done as a federal leader. I didn't need any other policy changes. I didn't need even budget changes. It was just a different way of maybe value stacking and exercising those. And the third part for me was really understanding what does it look like to create user-driven, you know, kind of technology. So you can imagine as I circle all these things up, coming to a place like the Air Force Research Lab, being able to serve as our CIO and as the head of our digital capability directorate, it feels like coming full circle, right? It's both kind of championing, you know, all of the new tech. It is understanding that it's in service of the warfighter. It is a lab and scientific, you know, place where we are advancing innovation and science and research. And most of all, we got to do it through technology, right? So it feels in some ways like a homecoming, and in some ways, what a terrifying role, right, to try to get all of that right. And so I'm really kind of honored to be entrusted with that and hope I'm making a difference.
Oh, man. Well, it does sound like your path like perfectly landed you into the spot you're in right now, whether you intended it or not.
Yeah.
So that's so cool. And you're pretty new on the job, right? It's only been a few months. Yeah. Am I wrong?
No, I just passed kind of my 90th day mark a couple weeks ago, maybe right before Thanksgiving. And wow, right? I mean, 90 days in, you know, first of all, just wow from the incredible amount of just brilliance, right? I mean, this is the Air Force Research Lab. We support Air Force, we support Space Force, who are some of the biggest brains, right, on the block and around the world. And so doing that, but also really kind of saying, what does that practically look like, right, from a technology lens? What does it look like from a culture or behavior lens? You know, what is the types of ways that we want people to behave or to be able to exercise their expertise in a digital age? And I think those are as interesting as whether or not we use a particular cloud, right, or whether or not we're AWS.
Well, I feel like it's, even though it's brand new, 90 days, that's not new. Like it's not the first month, but it's enough. You've probably got your feet a little bit wet. So what you're probably if I know a little bit of you, you're probably stirring. You're ready to do something is my guess. So where's your head at? What are you seeing? What vision are you manifest?
It's really neat about kind of going in and out of public sector and private sector and getting to kind of macinate between the two, is that one of the things I really realize is that in and out journey has allowed me to kind of unhitch my identity, if you will, in a way that I think lets me kind of sit back in these 90 days and say, like, what is interesting about what I'm seeing, right? What is, you know, something where, because it's really hard to see the forest for the trees, like once you've been in the forest for a long time. And so, you know, I was eager to come back to the forest, but I think stepping back and saying, okay, what is unique about this moment? And not just the place that I'm in and the people I work with, but what's unique about this moment in time? And I think that there are a couple things that have really crystallized for me. I think one is that, You know, when we think about government and we think about DOD and we think about kind of the average change horizon that our leaders had to navigate, you know, that used to be kind of 5 to 15 years. You know, it would take that long for a concept to come out or a new platform, a new weapons platform, you know, a policy or a value, and for that to kind of play out, you know, and become ultimately a legacy system, right, 15 years later. Yeah, I think what is interesting now is that 5 to 15 years is really about 6 months to 1.2 years. And if you think about it, at a human level, that means that, you know, leaders within AFRL and other leaders that we support across, you know, Air Force and DOD and Space Force, that means that those leaders are having to make 5 times or more the amount of decisions in the same period of time. Right. And that's actually really game changing. If you step back and say, wow, what does that mean for us? You know, the second factor is that about 90% of the world's information really came online, so to speak. And so not only are we talking about leaders who have to make maybe bigger, faster decisions than ever, but they have 1,000, 100,000 times more information to make that decision, right? And I think that's a really interesting, you know, kind of question of what does it look like to be a great leader? And so when I sit back and I think about the role of CIO or digital, I really ask myself, well, what are the behaviors, right, that I want to be able to empower? I think one is I really want to be able to empower curiosity, right? Because if we're in a constant state of change, people have got to be able to get the right information, the right time, and ask the right questions, right? And we're seeing things like AI or modeling and simulation and a lot of these types of things really be huge manifestations, right, of that curiosity. I think the other thing, there's kind of 3 factors that I'm looking at. You know, the first is that relationship with knowledge. You know, what is it to have a really intentional relationship with knowledge? So I'm stepping back in this role of CIO, and instead of saying, what about this platform or that platform or this tool, what I'm really asking, you know, of myself and of other leaders here is, what is the relationship with knowledge we want to have, right, moving forward? The second is time. And what I mean by that is when I step back strategically and I look at, you know, at kind of the adversarial context, what I was struck by is the fact that the only thing that we and our adversaries have exactly the same amount of is time, right? And so when I think about that, that decision parameter, the ability to make decisions faster, the ability to get the right information to respond quicker, you know, if I look at time as a weapon, right, how do I actually help, you know, contribute to wielding that weapon well and effectively? And the last one, I think, is identity, right? Because what I realized is most of the time, the things that slow us down in being able to adapt new technology or ask questions and be curious is really our own identities, right? How do we feel our relationship, you know, in kind of the status quo versus the new? And I'll give you an example of that. One of the things that's really interesting about looking, for example, at IT and technologist roles is a lot of times the identity of the IT or technologist becomes very tied to a platform, right? They are the person who implements Palantir or Microsoft or ServiceNow or, you know, or Workspace or any of those things. And if you think about it, when people's identity get tied with platforms, it's not surprising that they may be hesitant to see those platforms or those tools or those approaches change because who they are has become intrinsically tied to that. I think a really neat opportunity for us is to step back in, especially in the IT and data and information and knowledge space, and say, hey, I don't actually value you because of the particular tool or platform, you know, or system that you, you know, navigate on our behalf or our mission. What I value you for is the knowledge, right? And what I want is for you to be a knowledge champion, to make sure that critical information that a leader or, you know, or an operator needs, that you're in essence delivering that as prolifically, as quickly as possible. You know, Bonnie, what's been interesting is as we've changed that sense of identity, right, slowly but surely, what you'll find is people will say, well, if I'm going to be responsible for the knowledge, there's actually a different way I do it. right? I might use AI or a new tool differently, you know, if I'm a steward of knowledge versus a steward of a system. And I think that's a really interesting question for us on an identity issue as leaders.
I'm taking a pause because I'm soaking it all in. I'm going to start from the top. Empowering curiosity. My team, I think, relates to this deeply because this also connects with some of the strategy guidelines, you know, you might see coming from DOD or even my office and the CDAO. Deputy Secretary Hicks most recently issued or published the AI strategy. It talks about experimentation. And I think there are lots of undertones of curiosity there, but these are just strategy documents. So like, where does your head go in terms of how do we foster an environment where people feel they can be curious and, you know, whatever culturally they're used to, you know, whether it's being compliance oriented or if your culture dictates you do what somebody else tells you, your superior tells you to do. Maybe it's a chain of command thing. So where does your head go?
Yeah, so many places. I mean, I think the first is, again, as a really unique moment in time when we think about curiosity, most of our relationship with information and the things that we could be curious about within government and defense systems before were all what I would call controlled or structured information, right? We were very specific about we want this information in this field and this is valid. And what was interesting is that in most organizations, you know, at best, that might be 20% of the knowledge an organization has that is controlled and structured and organized. So the question for me becomes, and the power of curiosity becomes, what happens when the other 80%, right, the unstructured, and if you think about it, Bonnie, the brilliance, the humanness, the judgment, the, you know, the discovery is in the unstructured, right? It is in the after action report. It is in, you know, the scientific research white paper. It is in, that's really where we exercise, you know, the incredible richness of knowledge. And so to me, I think the first thing is, if we want to be serious about being curious, we got to put all the knowledge on the table, right? We have to understand the difference between structured and unstructured, but we have to stop only considering controlled information to be relevant. And we have to start thinking that catalytic or curiosity-driven information has an equal place, right? I think that's number one. I think number two is we have to realize that people are naturally curious by nature. This is one of the most brilliant, incredible things about being human, right? But what's so interesting is it's so easy to beat that out of people, right? I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, the more we have toil, the harder it is to find information, the more hoops we have to jump through. I call it toil very specifically and not friction or not whatever, because toil has an emotional component, right? If it's hard for me to be curious, if it's painful for me to be curious to ask a question, then I'm just not going to do it. What I found in my very kind of back of the envelope level research is that even if someone has significant conviction and passion and believes in their curiosity, if they start going down that path, by the time they hit the third block, right, to that curiosity, they've lost about 70% of their momentum. Right? And that's when they're convicted and when they're passionate. So imagine how many people we lose just in the thought of what they'd have to navigate to be curious, right? And that's where it may not be sexy, but making it easier, right, for someone to find a piece of information. And this is where I think tools like Bard or ChatGPT have really exploded, right? Because they've allowed people to be curious the same way maybe you could Google it, right? And that ability to exercise that and to harness that, I think, are really key. But we can't underestimate what toil does to kill curiosity. And I actually think, you know, that curiosity is the most important weapons platform of our future, right? We are literally going to have to out-curious and out-create and out-maneuver our adversaries. And it's a muscle. And it's something that we have to have people work out. And we have to remove all the barriers to the gym, right, of that muscle.
It's almost like you're relating it to the adversary, but I think that curiosity has to start internally. So we have to outmaneuver our own bureaucracy and get curious about, why am I filling out this piece of paper? Or I don't even know, right? Like, or how do I get access to the knowledge I think I need to connect the dot, you know, that will improve, you know, this end user's life.
Yeah, and sometimes like that knowledge comes in really interesting forms, right? It could be, who can I ask about this, right? It could be another person. It could be an expert, right? So there's knowledge there. It could be, you know, work that had already been done and that you just weren't exposed to. But I think the interesting thing for me about this is that even I love the name of, you know, the podcast, like, you know, the Mavericks, because I think what one of the things we have to figure out is how to stop making innovation a game of heroics, right? Like I overcame like all of this bureaucracy or these odds. And the reality is like, it's perfectly within our control to lessen the heroism required, right? To be curious or to have the right information. And I think that's a really interesting question for me right now. In fact, one of the things I'm asking my team to do very specifically is anything we're looking to improve or to do differently or to emphasize, we start with a toil calculation. Like, what does it cost or take for someone to do that now? And before we prioritize it or before we do it, we got to be really clear on what we're improving, right? And that could, sometimes that's a policy issue, right? It's not a technology or app issue, but being really clear and owning that. I think the other thing on that in particular is as we navigate the richness and the complexity of what it is to be, you know, defense contributors and leaders, we have to navigate balance, right? So as, for example, I might look at something that really reduces a researcher's toil, I have to balance that with security questions, right? Or protocols or cyber issues. And one of the things I'm really asking the team to be intentional about is what is the trade-off, right? If we add more from a security load, we have to accept the fact that we're slowing down research. And that might be a perfectly viable trade-off, but we should be intentional about that trade-off, right? We should be able to put numbers and math and make sure our leaders understand, you know, that in this game of time being an advantage, we have to start playing the board, right, in that way, and not just think that adding on this request or adding on this signature or putting this thing doesn't have an impact, because it does.
Yeah. And I like that a lot, because I think the norm is to sacrifice speed for certainty. And I think what you're offering is actually making it a trade-off. That doesn't have to be the default. It's an option, but you have to understand what you're trading off. And I couldn't agree more. It's something I think we're not super skilled at applying. And I think that's the work you have in front of you.
Well, and I think too, we don't have empathy for what we're asking of leaders to exist in both of those headspaces, right? So as a leader, one of the most interesting things in my first 90 days or someone trying to contribute to this is like, what kind of leader am I? The kind of leader who's gonna really be aggressive and lean in and beat the adversary? Or am I the kind of leader who is worried about going to jail and being prosecuted, right, for making the wrong cyber move? And that's a real reality, right? I mean, there's real reputation and identity. And so every day I kind of have to wake up to your point of trade-offs. And I think my solution has been to be intentional about those, right? To be able to point and say, here is what the trade-off looks like. And therefore, here is the decision that I can sleep at night with, right, as a leader, as we make those.
This is all, I feel like, colliding in an area where when you talked about the humanness of what we're dealing with and how it relates to, I'll say, modernizing or even doing digital transformation, so that there is a humanness that should be addressed that maybe is not always the thing we think about when we're trying to deliver capability. How are you approaching that in your seat?
Yeah. So I think one of my biggest lessons learned in my last opportunity to contribute, you know, in kind of federal leadership and innovation was to recognize that most of what we do, I'll say most of what I had done previously, was we focus a lot on the do, right? It's like, we're going to do this differently or this. And by simply kind of putting, you know, recategorizing the do or doing differently, that will solve it. And I think the humanist comes in when we realize that people don't just do, they also think and feel, right? So to my point of, you know, the idea of one of my technologists or an IT person having identity as, you know, as the steward of a particular platform or tool, part of what I had to do was help them think differently about themselves, right? I'm actually more important than this tool. I actually am a shepherd of this knowledge, and that is a bigger job, right? And a bigger calling and a bigger purpose. And, you know, once someone can think, and most importantly, they can feel, they can take pride, right? In the sense that they have a bigger role, that they have a more critical purpose, you know, path, then what tends to happen is the do or the change sticks, right? Because it is part of someone's values. It's part of their belief. It's part of, you know, how they approach the role. It's part of how they see themselves. And I think oftentimes in government, in DOD, we think simply changing the do will solve it. And this is where one of the things I loved about how they set up the approach here is, you know, this idea of what are digital capabilities, not digital transformation, because transformation kind of implies there's an endpoint. Like, we've been transformed, right? If we want to talk about curiosity, we want to talk about really being leaders in a constant time of change, it's really adaptation, right? It's really capability adjustment. And so I think as we do that, we can't be so naive to think that our humanness, you know, only happens in the do, because I think where we start in our thinking, our feeling, our values ultimately really decides whether the do is going to get done.
I like the play on thinking and feeling versus doing for a lot of reasons. Not only does it make sense in life, in particular in the settings that we're, you know, working day to day in, though, recognizing everyone's at a different, like, how do you meet people where they're at? Everyone's at a different level. And you can't expect, I actually had a moment, I would say in cross collab event where there was people from DOD, Fed Civ agencies and whatnot. And somebody was genuinely asking, what is ChatGPT? And I distinctly remember thinking, I am in a bubble. Like, that is a no kidding reality, that there is a group of people who are just not paying attention, not invested, not interested. To your point, we haven't created the value for them internally as to why it either improves their lives or makes their work life better, whatever. So I think that's a valid point. I just wanted to kind of foot stomp there for a second.
And I mean, I think one thing that's really interesting is if you take ChatGPT as an example, when I was doing an AI 101 class for leaders, both at Google and then between Google and coming out of this new role, I ran an experiment in my AI 101 leaders class. And you know, the experiment was that for some people, I would introduce generative AI in the sense of their professional capacity, right? And we'd use examples of here's how, you know, you could use this in your work. And then for another group, I would split it and in essence say, I would introduce it from a personal, like kind of play level. I would say, you know, hey, use it to write a love note to your spouse, right? Use it to make a shopping list. And, you know, Bonnie, you probably won't be surprised that as I was moving forward and as I then kind of asked them to think about how this might be useful, you know, in their lives, what was interesting is that the people who were introduced in it from a play standpoint were actually saw much greater value, but more importantly, they would voluntarily list off out of kind of a curiosity connector things that they thought that might be useful in their work. Where if they were introduced to it from their work, they would actually create far less, you know, kind of ways of using it. And what I realized as I pulled into this is that introducing it from that mindset of play and letting someone take it as a journey in that identity to maybe this could be useful to my professional life was far less threatening than in essence introducing it, you know, professionally. And because the where people's head tends to go is, you know, well, what is its relevance to me? How does it remove or add, right, to my relevance? Where if you start it from, you know, a more curiosity-based thing, people actually can take themselves on that journey. And I think one of the things with AI in particular that we have an opportunity to maybe correct, but probably got out of, you know, out of the gate is we didn't realize that ability to exercise curiosity, that ability to play, to explore, but really the ability to kind of say, why this technology now? What does it actually bring you versus kind of our AI versus their AI, right? And kind of at the tool level, we didn't take people on a human journey. And I think that's a really, you know, interesting and profoundly effective place to start people, and especially to start leaders, you know, who themselves aren't clear on these tools or their relevance.
Well, I love it. I love that someone in your position is saying and messaging these things and challenging their teams to think differently. I think only goodness can come from that. So what does the next 90 days look like for you? What is, you know, do you have a target yet, or are you just going to continue to build these foundations you've been describing?
No, I mean, there is thinking and feeling only matters as much as it impacts doing, right? And so I think that there's a couple of things that I'm really excited about contributing to. I think one is, you know, is being very intentional and cognizant of, again, what is our relationship with knowledge? And that means making technical decisions, right? That's things like, how do I ensure that we have as adaptable an architecture as possible, right? And especially in a place like, you know, RL, like what a great and rich example of, for example, federated IT, right? Really taking IT to each individual mission across, you know, across the research lab. And so I think, you know, asking questions about what does an architecture look like that enables the power of that federation, right? Enables the breadth of that knowledge, but also makes it really easy, you know, to look at interoperability, right? Or portability. How do I serve up that information, and how do we as a team? And so, you know, really looking at, you know, kind of what does API first look like for us, right? What does it look like to bring that information to bear? What are our toil calculations telling us, right? So where are researchers spending, losing time? Where might our ability to transition, you know, discovery to, you know, to operators or to private sector or other people that can help at scale? Where is, you know, where are the information gaps on that? And I think big questions like, if time is an advantage, how are we going to lean into our AI work, our modeling and simulation work, and the fact that those are really the critical place that curiosity is, you know, is advantaged, and how do we use those as places that people can exercise that curiosity, right, and have that type of joy of discovery that is, you know, self-perpetuating, if you will.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier how you don't want to see the innovation become a game of heroics. So I too believe this is part of, I don't know, my passion project, so to say, is making everyone in contracting in particular feel like the hero of their own story. Like that should be normalized. Everyone should feel like that. You mentioned, because not just because all roads lead to contracts, but because, to your point, it doesn't have to be an occasional or a rare circumstance where, you know, the defense maverick comes through and creates a thing. Like that can be anybody, literally anybody. So like, I'm trying to normalize the concept of a defense maverick. So what does that mean to you? Like when you hear of a defense maverick, what resonates with you?
Yeah. I mean, I think a defense maverick, first and foremost, is humbly curious, right? Like a real maverick isn't about knowing everything. It's about wanting to know, right? It's about wanting those options, wanting to know. It's also about the fact that like innovation and advancement, it's a contact sport, right? It's a team sport. It is, you know, sometimes people think, especially about like, you know, our work and discovery in a lab, you know, it's not like the movies. It's not like there's someone sitting in a dark room that says, Eureka, right? I've discovered. It is like my idea bounces off of your idea, which hits your research, right? And so I think recognizing that it's a contact sport, and there's an element of humanity of like, great, be a good human that people want to have contact with, right? When someone comes away in working with you, they should feel more invigorated about their mission. They should feel more positive. They should feel more hopeful. And if you are not a person who makes someone feel more capable or more excited about this challenge or this sticky thing that they're trying to tackle, you know, then like shame on you, right? If someone's willing to step up and willing to do the hard work or face the toil, you know, it's really our job just to cheer them on, to figure out how to get, you know, the right information, how to co-create with them. But we've got to really think about how we show up, right? Because that toil, again, it's not just putting the bureaucracy in place. It's the chilling effect of only pointing out what could go wrong, right? Or only pointing out the risk. And so I think, you know, being intentional in the way we contribute to others and show up for others is a really critical part to me, first and foremost, of any great maverick and any person that I can look at and say, wow, that person really gave me the confidence or the, you know, the punch in the arm. There's a woman, in fact, I'll call out and celebrate, great leader, Jen Gustetic, right, who's been with NASA and was with OSTP for a long time. I wasn't even in the innovation game, and, you know, and I met her and Tom Kleel and others, and they were like, you can do this, go do that, go figure it out, right? And I didn't have any street cred, you know, at the time in innovation. And a couple of years later, I was the chief innovation officer at USAID, right? And it takes, I think, people to tell you you can do it that are really critical and often unsung heroes in that process.
Yeah, it's taking that inaugural step to the unknown is very scary and very real, and it takes a village, you know? Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated your insights today. Hopefully this was a good time for you.
This is awesome. And most of all, like, you know, for those people out there that have a bit of maverick or a lot of maverick in them, you know, I just appreciate being able to recognize, like, we're in a fundamentally different time. Like, no joke, we are really facing a fundamentally different time in history, a different moment, and maverick's got to step up, right? You got to bring it, because, like, we are not going to meet the challenges that are going to happen in the next 6 hours, 6 months, 6 years, you know, 6 decades without people being curious, you know, supporting each other and bringing this to, you know, this to bear.
I feel like the only way to close this is my 8-year-old. Every time, like, sharing sentiments like that, she's like, slay queen, get it, girl.
I'm going.
Awesome job. Thank you so much for some conversation today.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me. And thanks for making space for people to have these conversations.